This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Dream Defenders lay out a broad assault on racism in the criminal justice system. A new Black think tank combines scholarship and activism. And what does Robert Mugabe's victory in Zimbabwe mean to Africa?
But first, supporters of Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer, serving a 10-year prison sentence, who is suffering from stage 4 breast cancer, got some bad news last week. The judge who sent her to prison rejected her request for compassionate release, saying he had no choice in the matter because the Obama administration had previously turned Stewart down. Ralph Pointer is Lynn Stewart's husband and lifelong comrade in struggle. We asked him, what's the next step?
What is next is what Lynn had expected. She had urged her lawyers to file for compassionate release, even if the papers were not finished. And as a matter of fact, 3 weeks ago, she reapplied for compassionate release to be ready the moment that it was turned down by Judge Codal. He had said he would give it expeditious attention when it came from the Bureau of Prisons. Now, that is the letter of the law, that it has to come from the Bureau of Prisons, recommended by them. Now, under Lynn's first appeal for compassionate release, the warden at Carswell Federal Medical Center and the physicians there agreed that Lynn should have compassionate release, and they filed for it as per the law. And then in an extraordinary situation, the Justice Department, under Samuelson, who was the head of the National Federal Bureau of Prisons, let it sit on his desk for 8 weeks, never answering it. Now, I will allow people to use their own judgment as to what happened there. And along with this set of facts, that the Bureau of Prisons, Samuelson in Washington, D.C., didn't act on the warden's from Carswell application for compassionate release for Lynn as per law, then we find out that the Justice Department has argued against Lynn's cert before the Supreme Court to have her case heard in another very unusual situation. So we have the administration in Washington, that is Obama, Holder, pulling the strings to keep another whistleblower, Lynn Stewart, in prison.
They seem intent on keeping her there until she departs.
Until death.
Now, the judge, what do you read into his ruling? The legal language is rather dry, but did you get the impression that he would have liked to have...
Yes, that's what he has been saying, that if he were to grant Lynn's compassionate release, it would be breaking the law. The law is very specific. It says that after a person applies for compassionate release, the warden has to look at that and forward it on the behalf of the prisoner. The prisoner cannot do it without the warden's consent. The warden at Carswell consented. He read the papers of the attending physicians, and they said Lynn has complied with all the necessary conditions for compassionate release, and this is where the trouble continued. In Washington, with Samuelson, with the Justice Department, and I call it under the guide of President Obama, who seems to enjoy doing the work of this oppressive corporate juggernaut that is squeezing us all, keeping the truth from us all, and continuing the oppression of the American people. But the judge did question the prosecutor as to his understanding that Lynn was dying. And the prosecutor answered he was perfectly aware, but he challenged the judge on the law. This is where we are. And I just want people to understand it is clear where this is coming from. And you put that together with the government's opposition in a rare situation to challenge Lynn's right to go to the Supreme Court, it makes sense. It begins to fit, even for those who do not want to recognize who and what Mr. Obama is and who or where this government is going.
And now for Lynn's supporters, the pressure must be brought directly against Eric Holder and the president.
Exactly. And we can no longer kid ourselves. We must notice that the unions who have talked about bringing justice to their membership, and if you don't have a lawyer, your membership can have no justice. The unions have not participated as a group in the support of Lynn Stewart, Bradley Manning, Snowden, or any other of the issues around the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, etc. The ministers have not participated in this struggle. And but what I say to people of color who voted for Obama on the average of 90% must understand who is on their side. And if they understand the 35 years of service to our community by Lynn Stewart and then see what their president is doing to Lynn Stewart, and I'm continuing my dance in front of the White House until Lynn is freed or until we pick her up in a box.
That was Ralph Pointer, husband and comrade of people's lawyer Lynn Stewart.
Young people from Florida and across the country have been occupying the governor's office in Tallahassee in the wake of George Zimmerman's acquittal in the killing of Trayvon Martin. They call themselves the Dream Defenders. Ciara Taylor is a spokesperson for the young people. She says their concerns go way beyond stand your ground laws.
Correct. And the reason that we're doing that is because the Dream Defenders recognize what we're calling the criminalization of our youth here in Florida. We see that some practices and behaviors in Florida, and I think around the country as well, that feed into criminalizing our youth, like making our young black and brown people look as though something to be feared or suspicious of. And we believe that's done with the school-to-prison pipeline that takes children out of schools and into jail cells. And also racial profiling practices that are not only used today, but in many places legalized and almost justified by the law. And so that we want to disassemble all three of the practices in Florida so that we can have a safer place for our children to grow up in.
Racial profiling is often used to focus on instances in which a particular person is profiled. But isn't that subject a much larger one? The profiling of a whole community, the profiling of black people as a group.
Yes, of course. That's the biggest thing that, you know, people could see on the surface level. But I think that the reason why we go into the school to prison pipeline is because Trayvon Martin would not have even been in Sanford, Florida at that time had it not been for an out-of-school suspension that he received off the basis of zero tolerance policy.
Beyond Stand Your Ground, could you outline for us what legislative ideas you're outlining?
Aside from reviewing and eventually repealing Stand Your Ground law, we're also looking at the school-to-prison pipeline, and that's through us feeling the need to eliminate zero tolerance policies that will not only save children from a lifetime of being in the criminal justice system, but it will also save taxpayers a lot of money. You know, Florida spends up to four times more incarcerating a child than it does bringing a child to the education system. And I believe the statistic is, you know, it's almost $281 million that's spent on an adult who lost their future through the juvenile justice system, you know, not being able to work and therefore take care of themselves. So it's very taxing, literally, on the state of Florida.
Florida isn't that different from the rest of the country.
I mean, yes, definitely. I mean, there are 31 other states in the United States that have something similar to the standard ground law in their state. However, you know, there's been a boiling of many issues that have played into the overflow of what's happening in our state right now in regards to civil rights, social rights, and rights of children to grow up in a safe environment. So, that has to do with Governor Scott and the way that he has been governing the state. He hasn't really given our children a chance or are people a chance? And that's, I mean, that's a myriad of issues, right? That's, you know, immigration, that's healthcare, that's the treatment of our women. So that's why I think Florida is most significant, because of the leadership, or rather lack thereof.
What would you count as victories so far in your teaching?
I mean, I think so far victories are getting the House Speaker, Will Rutherford, to agree to a committee hearing during committee week in September. I think being able to get our message out as well and as broadly as we have been able to do so far. I feel as though we're educating a lot of people, you know, not only in Florida, but around the world, on what the Florida Prison Pipeline is, like how do you identify racial profiling. And I think the support that we've gotten has to do with a big win for us. You know, it's people being able to understand where Florida youth are coming from and the way that they're being brought up in the state.
And how long do you plan to continue the teaching or some kind of physical presence?
We plan to be at the Capitol for as long as it takes.
What does as long as it takes mean?
Until we have a good enough win, you know, something that will actually make a difference. Holding a hearing on Stand Your Ground is not enough, you know, when there are so many other things that are affecting our youth in Florida. We have to review Florida Prison Pipeline policies and how we can, you know, eliminate them so that our children can flourish as productive members in society. And we also look at racial profiling. That's basically creating more of a divide in this country, because we're teaching people, you know, young people especially, who are being brought up in this generation, that it's okay to judge someone by the color of their skin.
So you're prepared to stay there until passage of legislation to your satisfaction?
Not necessarily legislation. I mean, we're not asking anyone to pass anything as of right now. We are asking for fairness. You know, we were here during legislative session beginning last March, this past March in 2013, and we had bills on immigration, protecting undocumented people's rights. We had bills on juvenile justice. We had bills on voting rights. And not one of them was heard, you know, in the committee meetings, you know, during legislative session. We brought parents and children from around the state to come to speak to the representatives, and if we were even able to get the representatives to listen to them, we still weren't able to have the bills heard in session. So we just want to be heard at this point and have these items reviewed.
Ciara Taylor of the Dream Defenders in Tallahassee, Florida.
The U.S.-backed government in Haiti is formulating new laws to attract foreign mining corporations into the gold fields in the northern part of the country. The scramble for gold has stirred nationalist pride in Haiti. According to Kim Ives, an editor of the weekly magazine of news and analysis, Haiti Liberté.
It's probably the most sensitive nerve point in the Haitian nationalist body, because we have to recall that Christopher Columbus, when he landed in 1492 on Hispaniola, gold was his object then. And so this has become part of the historical memory of the Haitian people. The gold in the ground is what they're after. And the drama of it is that the group in power, the Martelly group, is essentially some kind of mafia, and so they are essentially joining hands with this international mafia of gold companies going around the world raping countries in Latin America in particular. So the people are very worried that the words of protecting Haitian national interests and sovereignty are essentially a cover for the exact opposite.
According to an article in the Interpress News Service, 2,400 square kilometers of Haitian land in the north has already been parceled out to what the article describes as Haitian firms fronting for U.S. and Canadian companies.
Yes, and as we had this week in articles in Haiti Liberté, a group we work closely with, Haiti Grassroots Watch, they have essentially been mobilizing to push back against this takeover of land, which has happened in a large extent in the Dominican Republic next door, one of the largest gold mines on the island, but also one of the largest ecological disasters is happening just about 100 kilometers away across the border in the Dominican Republic. So Haitian grassroots groups are very worried.
Why would these Canadian and U.S. and other foreign companies have to use Haitian front companies to hide the ownership of those leases?
Because it's in Haiti what they call the politique de doubleur. It's a lot the same way they put Obama in charge of the ruling class machinery here in the U.S., and this has been a policy done in Haiti for many years. Put a black face on imperialist interests, put a Haitian company in front of an American conglomerate. So the people are wise to this tactic, and I don't think that they're fooled for a minute by the decoys that they're putting out in front.
Most of the people in that region make their living through agriculture. What kind of threat does mining represent to them?
Well, a huge threat, as many people know. Cyanide is one of the chemicals that are critical, especially in the type of gold that's found in the Haitian hills. Most of the veins of pure gold were cleaned out by the Spanish centuries ago. So what remains are really gold dust and flecks, which are sprinkled throughout large quantities of the Haitian mountains. So to get these specks out, what they have to do is use a lot of cyanide, a lot of treatment, and it means taking out huge swaths of mountains. So not only the land that Haitians rely upon for food sovereignty and for growing their own crops, but the water becomes completely polluted with these chemicals, again, principally cyanide. And once again, across the border in the Dominican Republic, they have rivers that are now running red. It's practically a symbol of the bloody nature of the disaster which has been wrought.
And what is the participation of the Haitian legislature in putting together these new regulations on mining?
Well, the Haitian Senate has the core of the nationalist and progressive legislators in it. Unfortunately, the Martelly group, which has money to burn, principally through Laurent Lamothe, the prime minister, who is some kind of telecommunications tycoon, they've been able to buy off large segments, until recently at least, a majority of the deputies. But in the Senate, there is a core of senators, in particular Senator Moïse Jean-Charles and a colleague of his from the North, Senator Polycarpe, who, given that a lot of the mining is precisely in the area of the country where they are from, have pushed very hard to have legislation put in place that would curtail and control any mining in that area. So this is an ongoing legislative battle, and the government claims it is responding to the parliament's measures, but we feel, and of course many grassroots groups feel, is that it's all bluff.
And of course, mining does not produce many local jobs.
Correct. So many of the technicians brought in are from overseas, and much of this mining is really done with giant machinery now. You're talking really about mountaintop removal style mining, not the traditional gold mines burrowing into the mountains. Again, this is essentially gold dust, which is spread through hundreds of meters of rock, and so you have to take out all that rock and then basically pulverize it, and using, again, these chemicals like cyanide, get the gold out.
And so Haiti, which has lost so much of its forest cover, is now going to lose much of its land itself.
Correct. And the other element to this, Glenn, is the erosion that results, because already Haiti has lost 98% of its original forest cover. We have to remember when Christopher Columbus arrived, he named the island Hispaniola in honor of Spain because of the beautifully verdant mountains that he saw covered with all types of mahogany and other trees, which have all been decimated. And the result is that hundreds of tons of topsoil are carried by rain into the oceans every year. This is silting also the fisheries off the coast of Haiti. So it's a lose-lose proposition. Your groundwater is being tainted. Your land is being despoiled. The erosion is stripping away the topsoil, and all the coastline is being silted. So it's a terrible situation.
But win-win for the foreign extraction companies.
Exactly.
That was Kim Ives of the news magazine Haiti Liberté.
Robert Mugabe, the man who has been president of Zimbabwe since that country was liberated from white rule in 1980, won 60% of the vote in elections late last month, trouncing his U.S.-backed opponent, Morgan Tsvangirai, who'd served as prime minister in a coalition government. Eric Dreitzer is a political analyst and founder of the website StopImperialism.com. Dreitzer says the vote was a huge win for Mugabe and his party.
The landslide victory in Zimbabwe really came as no surprise to people who were following it closely, because what we saw over the course of the last few years is that as the Movement for Democratic Change and Morgan Tsvangirai was allowed into the government and allowed into positions of power, they really did show their true colors, their neoliberal colors, as it were, where the people of Zimbabwe came to realize that beyond all of the rhetoric, beyond all of the hype, and beyond all of the outside support, the Movement for Democratic Change really offered very little in the way of benefits for the people of Zimbabwe, whereas, on the other hand, ZANU-PF, and led, of course, by Robert Mugabe, offered not only the indigenization program, not only the land reforms, but even just the idea of economic independence. Beyond just this nominal political independence, ZANU-PF really did come to symbolize in this election what Zimbabweans, or the vast majority of Zimbabweans, believe to be the most important issue of all, and that is true post-colonial independence.
And in fact, the voter turnout was about twice as heavy as in 2008.
Exactly right. And part of that, I think, we should attribute to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, because remember that after those 2008 elections, one of the major criticisms was that ZANU-PF controlled the entire democratic procedure. And so one of the stipulations was that there would be this coalition that would put together this electoral commission. And I think that it was that structural change within the electoral processes that not only opened up the democratic procedures for more people in Zimbabwe, but I think it lent credence to the idea that there was a democratic process in that country, that it was worthwhile to take part and to vote and to express one's opinion. And I think that's what we see reflected in the numbers.
And can this be seen as a plebiscite also on the land reform?
Oh, there's no question about it, and I would even go one step further. Not only is it a plebiscite on the land reform, it's really kind of a barometer reading of what Africa is really thinking. There are many countries in Africa that are looking at Zimbabwe, looking at land reform, looking at indigenization, and hoping that it is successful, not only successful in terms of the sheer numbers, but successful in transforming the political, economic, and perhaps most importantly, social institutions within the country. One of the things that Mugabe and ZANU-PF have stressed really since 1980, since the official end of the liberation struggle, is the fact that political independence is meaningless without economic independence. And if you look around Africa, there really are very few, if any, countries, perhaps with the exception of Eritrea, that actually have real economic independence. And so it is a plebiscite on land reform, on indigenization, but also on Mugabe, on ZANU-PF, and on the notion of whether or not countries in Africa can actually be truly independent.
Certainly, South Africa has not redistributed the land.
No, certainly not. And in fact, what we've seen in South Africa is exactly the opposite. It is the re-entrenching of colonial and imperial presence through this neoliberal domination that exists there. The ruling class in South Africa, though it may have black faces, it is still beholden to international capitalism, to neoliberal finance capital primarily. And so rather than a redistribution in South Africa, it is only the facade of independence, only the facade of political control in the hands of the people, when in fact the people are still screaming for their true economic independence. If you look at the landless peasants movements, the urban shack dwellers movement, if you look at the repression of the Marikana workers and the other labor struggles, if you look at the way in which the institutions in South Africa are beholden to that ruling class, you can see that very little has truly changed in that country, whereas their neighbor to the north in Zimbabwe has experienced tremendous difficulties, overcome incredible obstacles with the odds stacked against it and the so-called international community treating it as a pariah state, and yet it has turned to be successful.
And just as with Venezuela, the United States is not recognizing the results of this Zimbabwean election.
Of course not, and I think it's quite indicative just based on the fact of who is rejecting the results. It is, of course, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, while at the same time, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, the African Union, the United Nations, international observers from all over the non-Western world, all of them agree that the elections were fair, that the elections were credible, and that the elections reflect the will of the people. So the question I think that people in internationally and in the United States need to ask themselves is, do I believe John Kerry and the State Department, or do I believe all of the other international institutions that have recognized this election? The answer is quite obvious. The United States has had a vested interest in maintaining the MDC and control in Zimbabwe, and one of the ways in which they've done that is through political subversion, and this election has shown quite clearly for the entire world that that subversion has failed, that even their economic strangulation in the form of sanctions has failed, that the people of Zimbabwe with ZANU-PF and their revolutionary spirit have triumphed.
Eric Dreitzer, founder of StopImperialism.com, speaking from New York.
On the 5th of every month, supporters of the Cuban Five sent an open letter to President Obama, urging that he free them from U.S. prisons. 15 years ago, the young Cuban intelligence officers infiltrated Cuban exile groups in Florida who were plotting terrorist attacks. When Cuba informed the U.S. about the terrorist plots, Washington arrested the Cuban Five instead of the exiles in Miami. They've been incarcerated ever since. Jane Franklin is an activist scholar and author of the book Cuba and the U.S., A Chronological History. She wrote this month's open letter to Obama on behalf of the Cuban Five. Franklin says it's absurd that the U.S. puts Cuba on a list of countries that sponsors terror when it is Washington that gives sanctuary to terrorists.
That doesn't make a lot of sense. It's very hypocritical because Cuba, for instance, has asked over and over again that the United States extradite Luis Posada, who helped mastermind the bombing of the Cubana Flight 455 in 1976 that killed 73 people. And Cuba has constantly asked for his extradition to Venezuela, because Venezuela wants to try him for the 73 murders, because he and Orlando Bush planned the bombings from Venezuela, where he lived at that time. And he escaped from prison after they arrested him.
And what is the United States' excuse for not sending him to Venezuela? It's not listed as a sponsor of terrorism or any such thing.
The United States, since President Hugo Chavez began asking for this extradition request in 2005, the year that Luis Posada came to the United States to live, he had been living in Central America, and when it became public that he was in the United States, President Chavez asked for him to be extradited, and Washington has never responded. The White House, simply the Justice Department, actually, has never responded to the request, which has been made repeatedly and was made again recently. President Maduro pointed out that it's hypocritical of Washington to demand the extradition of Edward Snowden when Washington refuses to extradite Luis Posada.
For Cuba, the number one issue in terms of relations with the United States, besides, of course, the embargo, is the Cuban Five. Are there any prospects for, say, an exchange of prisoners between the U.S. and Cuba that would include those who are still imprisoned among the Cuban Five?
Well, that question has to be rationally answered by Cuba and the United States. Cuba has asked over and over again to sit down and discuss anything at all with representatives from the United States. They want to have meetings and negotiations about any issue at all, including the issue of political prisoners. But the United States has shown no interest whatsoever in discussing any kind of release of the Cuban Five in exchange for anything.
After half a century, U.S. policymakers are still obsessed with trying to isolate Cuba. But especially in Latin America, it seems that the United States is the party that has become more isolated as a result of those policies.
Yes. In the year 2000, the OAS consisted of all 35 nations in the Western Hemisphere, with Cuba, though, suspended from coming to meetings. Now, the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, has 33 nations, excluding the United States and Canada. In other words, the new organization unites the whole of Latin America and the Caribbean in the Western Hemisphere, but excludes Canada and the United States. So things, that's been a paradigm shift. That's been a major political organization by Latin America and the Caribbean.
So one could conclude fairly that the loss of influence of the Organization of American States, which had excluded Cuba, has led directly to the formation of an organization of the Americas that excludes the United States and Canada.
Yes, you certainly could argue that. I think that's true. And that all began with the organization of the Bolivarian Alliance of Latin America in 2004, when President Chavez and President Castro organized the organization of several states in Latin America to cooperate with each other in independence and sovereignty. And that organization still exists and has led to other nations joining it and seems to be thriving at this point. And that's a new development. It's a Bolivarian development. Bolivar was the great Latin American liberator, and his policies are being promoted by ALBA in this century.
That was Jane Franklin, author of the book Cuba and the U.S., A Chronological History.
Solomon Comasong is an educator and activist based in College Park, Maryland. He's assembled a new think tank of fellow activist educators and scholars called the Pan-African Collective for Advocacy and Action.
When we created this organization, we did want to take on some aspects of a think tank where we wanted to produce white papers, because getting kind of sick and tired that it's always these kind of white liberal or reactionary organizations that are looking at issues within the black community as if we're some kind of a terrarium or aquarium or incubator. They're poverty pimps, and they're just kind of doing that kind of research to fleece their own pockets. And so we did want to do white papers and produce our own white papers with the objective of actually using the research that we do within the white papers that we produce to actually go into the community to be able to turn these white papers into collective actions and advocacy within our own community. But we also wanted to incorporate an element of action and advocacy where our organization is not just solely a think tank, but it's also an organization of activists, scholars, organizers who are aimed at going into our own communities and working with other grassroots organizations, individuals, and the people within those communities to try to deconstruct systemic issues that plague our communities, such as institutional racism seems to be the umbrella, and so does white supremacy, but tackling things like the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration, stop and frisk policies, tackling education, health, and the assortment of the like, environmental issues, and looking at environmental issues from a radically different perspective, not just environmental issues from the white liberal perspective, but looking at environmental issues are also caused when the U.S. military post up throughout the world in places like Africa, throughout the global south, and Latin American countries. And the stories that are not told is that oftentimes these U.S. military outposts, they have chemical leaks. They produce all kinds of environmental damage in those areas by way of just their presence.
And from where have you drawn this collective of scholars, activists, educators, and organizers?
It's a collection of individuals that I've had the pleasure of doing work with throughout the years. And so it's folks who have a long, long history of activism and organizing under their belt. Folks like Obi Egbuna, Ben Woods, Sister Sama, Dr. Joseph Richardson, who is academic activist scholar at the University of Maryland, where he's one of the only scholars I know besides Michelle Alexander, who his entire focus is geared around the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration. But his work, he has a long, long history of actually taking his classrooms into communities where the prison industrial complex actually starts. It doesn't actually start when a young man or young woman is locked up, but it starts way before that in terms of these assaults on African communities within the U.S. And so his research is geared at significantly, radically lowering the recidivism rates, as well as doing work in these communities to prevent young folks from being targeted for stop frisk and incarceration in the first place. He does a lot of work in shock trauma units. And so these are individuals that I've known throughout the years, and we just kind of came together. It was through conversations, and it was just kind of an organic conversation, and we decided, you know what, let's go ahead and do it. Let's try to put together a mission statement. Let's try to create an outline in terms of what this organization would look like. And I should say this, Glenn, we borrowed from the inspiration of our elders and other organizations that precede us, such as the Council on African Affairs and the Universal Negro Improvement Association, as well as the Pan-African Congress, and really have borrowed from inspiration from the work that they were doing to make sure that we followed in our footsteps while creating our own signature. The only thing that we want to compete against is white supremacy and institutional racism.
Yes, in the contemporary black world, many activists have had no exposure to black think tanks, and many scholars have no experience in activism.
You're exactly right. A lot of these scholars are poverty pimps, and it's easy to find them, Glenn. They can routinely be found on MSNBC and CNN. They're routinely invited on shows like those. And that's another thing. We want to really show with our work to our community what activism is really all about and what it means to be politically active, because we believe that there are large segments of our community that have been politically misguided and have followed the likes of National Action Network and Al Sharpton and Rainbow Push Coalition, and historically these organizations have done some good work, but these organizations are also on the payroll of the Democratic Party. These organizations continue to genuflect and to serve as footstools for Barack Obama and his administration. If we are going to talk about police brutality and repression in the United States of America, we must connect the dots to imperialism, and we must connect the dots to solidarity with our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world who are suffering from police repression, but it goes by the name of U.S. imperialism through the military. It's really not too much different.
That was Solomon Komasong. The Pan-African Collective for Advocacy and Action will hold its first press conference in Washington, D.C. this week.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, America's most well-known political prisoner, receives a steady stream of visitors at the Pennsylvania prison where he's serving a life sentence. One of Mumia's recent visitors was Larry Hamm, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, based in Newark, New Jersey.
This was my first meeting with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and this was a benchmark experience in my life. It was an event that I will never, ever forget. When I remember the top three or four things in my life, this would be one of them, because Mumia Abu-Jamal is an extraordinary individual, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to sit down for almost 2 hours and talk with him.
Well, that's saying a great deal. You've had a rather extraordinary life yourself.
Yes, I've had the opportunity to meet many of the leaders of our time. I was a little young. I didn't get to meet Malcolm X and Dr. King, but I certainly had the opportunity to meet Rosa Parks and most of the other contemporaries of Dr. Martin Luther King. But let me say, at the beginning of our conversation, what I said to Mumia at the end, I told him before I left him that he represented to me and to many others the indomitable human spirit. The fact that not only did he not let the hell of prison destroy him, but that in fact, through his efforts, he's done more behind prison walls to bring about political consciousness than many of us who have our so-called freedom have on this side of the prison walls.
Well, I'm sure that you had a list of things that you wanted to talk about when you entered the prison. What, in fact, did you discuss?
We talked about a lot of things, mostly politics. We certainly talked about the national security state and the drift toward a police state and the slow move toward fascism to the right in this country. We talked about that. We talked about the media. Mumia definitely had some things to say about the media. He basically felt the media more than supports the status quo. In many instances, becomes the mouthpiece of the rulers in this society. And we also talked about the national security state. And in talking about that, you know, I was sharing with him some of my experiences in Newark, New Jersey. And also later on, I told him about a book I had read called No Left Turn. And in that book, No Left Turn, it talked about the FBI having a list at that time, this was the mid-70s, of about 15,000 people. It was probably much larger now. That should there be a state of emergency or martial law declared in the United States, the FBI will go and arrest, detain these 15,000 individuals. And one of the things Mumia told me was that he was on that list, and not for his work now, but for his work when he was still a teenager. As many people know, Mumia Abu-Jamal was a member of the Black Panther Party. And Mumia said when he got his file and reviewed his file, he discovered that he was on this list of people to be detained should a state of emergency or martial law be declared. We also talked a lot about President Obama, the Obama administration. He did not mince words when it came to the Obama administration. He said, in essence, that President Obama has been able to enact policies that George Bush could not have gotten away with. And we were talking about this also in relation to the whole NSA scandal and Snowden and WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning and so on and so forth. Mumia was very critical of the Obama administration not doing anything to curtail activities that were already initiated under the Bush administration, and then implementing stuff that didn't happen, like the drone strikes and other things that the Obama administration has been doing. He also talked about his activity in the prison, how he was mentoring other young prisoners. He mentioned a few in particular that he was starting to kindle their interest in reading, which they had initially expressed no interest in, and how he was giving them the kind of books that would also give them some progressive ideas, progressive history of this country. It was a good visit.
What kind of sources of information does Mumia have? I'm sure that he utilizes these visits by people like yourself to debrief on what's happening in the world of black political organizing.
Yes, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because we spent some time talking about the people who have come to visit Mumia recently. And he said in one visit, at one time, James Cone, one of the advocates of black theology, I'm sure you're familiar with James Cone, he said James Cone, Chris Hedges, and Cornel West all came at the same time to see him one day. And it was quite an experience for the prison guard because, you know, Cornel is a recognizable figure. So a lot of the prisoners, you know, instantly gravitated toward Cornel. We talked about some of the people who have been coming to visit him. Mumia talked a lot about the need to build the movement. He said we have to build the movement to transform this country. We went back to the 60s. We talked about the movement with Dr. King, the Poor People's Movement, and we talked about the upcoming March on Washington. Mumia did not mince his words about the need for grassroots organizing and the need to build and strengthen and mobilize around issues and get out in the street.
And what did he have to say about the very real effects politically on black folks following this Trayvon Martin saga with the acquittal of George Zimmerman?
We talked about that generally, but it's interesting. I want to go step back for a minute because I think some of your listeners might find this a little somewhat interesting. When we're talking about Trayvon Martin, and we talked about how people were trying to mobilize around the Trayvon Martin issue and other issues, Mumia raised the point that with the election of Barack Obama, his election has in effect help to demobilize people. And I thought that was very interesting. You know, he says that around a lot of these issues that there would be more mobilization probably if someone else was in the White House. But, you know, because Obama's black and because a lot of black folks want to get a brother a chance, so to speak, there's not as much opposition coming out from our community and other communities, for that matter. He certainly is encouraged by the mobilization that he has seen, but he made it clear to me he felt that the election of Barack Obama has in fact helped to demobilize and blunt resistance that we otherwise might see in this country.
You're ahead of what some believe is the most effective grassroots organization, black grassroots organization in the country. How does your conversation with Mumia, how will it affect the way you look at organizing day to day?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, let me say that my views are not much at variance with those that Mumia expressed. I think the thing I have to deal with that may be a little different is we have to deal with the practicalities of day-to-day living in the community. I mean, I certainly share Mumia's view about how the election of a black president, because this phenomenon is not only true at the national level, this phenomenon has been true at the local level. One could say, if we were to say philosophically, there's good and bad and everything, then one would say, on the one hand, black political power is good. It's good that black people got the right to vote. The fight to get the right to vote was a good thing. And even electing our own people to represent our own communities is an act of self-determination. But this issue of demobilization is something that if you talk to a lot of people that were around in the early black power years, I'm talking about late 60s, early 70s, when a lot of these black mayors were first getting elected, you could say that we saw that phenomenon maybe on a smaller scale then, and that may have something to do with why we have not seen more resistance at the local level, because, you know, just like folks have said, well, give the brother a chance with regard to Obama. I mean, he ain't got much time left to get a chance. You know, we've had one term. We're good into the second term. There are only a couple of good years left, so whatever he's going to try to do, he better do it. But you know, a lot of people are already feeling a sense of disappointment. But on the other hand, come election day, like with the last election, as disappointed as some or maybe even many black people, as disappointed as they may have been in what had been or had not been done by the Obama administration, still millions turned out to vote. In fact, there may have been higher percentages in 2012 than there were in 2008. So this gives us the reality that, well, yes, we know that the Obama administration has done things that the Bush administration could not have done, could not have gotten away with, would have put millions of people. Like, if this whole NSA scandal had broke under George Bush, there might have been a semi-revolution in this country. But because it happened under Obama, you know, a lot of people are not even connecting it to him. And the fact that he has gone after whistleblowers with more vigor than the Bush administration, i.e. Snowden, i.e. Bradley Manning, and others. So it's a question of trying to synthesize both theory and practice. You know, the theory that, yes, we know that Obama is the face of imperialism, but at the same time, those black people who have some, well, not all, but let's say a good majority of those black people who have some political conscience, who at least register and go out to vote, they're still supporting him. So how do we navigate that contradiction? How do we be critical of Obama without alienating the very people that we're trying to organize? And this is a delicate task. But, you know, we try to do it in part. We try to be critical when it's necessary to be critical. And I think thus far we've been fairly successful about it. But I have to tell you, I have to be honest and say, you know, when we're out, because, you know, we send a team of people out to do agitation recruitment every Saturday on Broad Market downtown North. And if you come too hard at Obama, people will step to you. But then that could as long as it doesn't get violent, it could also present the opportunity, you know, to struggle with people and, in fact, try to open their eyes and raise their consciousness. But it's a tough road to hoe.
You've got about 200 dues-paying members in northern New Jersey. I assume they're thrilled that at least one of them got to meet Mumia.
Yes. This is the first time I got to meet Mumia, and I would imagine this is the first time a member of the People's Organization for Progress had the opportunity to meet Mumia. But it's not our first encounter with Mumia. We actually had a mass meeting at one of our regular weekly POP meetings. We actually had Mumia call into us, and I think that was back in April. We called him. You know, prisoners get time to make phone calls at the public phone. So the connection was made to him, and then he spoke to us via telephone at the POP meeting, and there were about 150 people there at that meeting the night that Mumia was able to address us. And he got to talk for a good 6 or 7 minutes. But this was our second encounter with Mumia, but it was the first face-to-face meeting. As you know, Mumia has been in jail for more than 32 years. 28 of those years he spent on death row. And it has only been in the last 2 years that through the efforts of the movement and PAM Africa and all the people that have been supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal, through that effort, he's been taken off death row, and he's now in the general population. Some people may think the struggle to free Mumia is over, but freedom didn't mean free from death row. It meant free from prison. So there is a petition drive going with the goal to get 1 million signatures to free Mumia Abu-Jamal from prison. And if people want to sign on to that petition, they can Google or put in their search engine, Release Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the change.org petition will come up. And then if people want more information, they can email Bring Mumia Home. It's bringmumiahome@gmail.com. bringmumiahome@gmail.com if you want to get some more information on the effort to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. So the struggle to free Mumia is not over.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. It seems there are no limits to the government's massive spying program on Americans. Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report has this commentary on the latest revelations.
The racist, hypocritical, and failed war on terror has something in common with the racist, hypocritical, and failed war on drugs. I mean something new, not merely that they're both based on lies to propagate public fear, or that they're both great white holes which politicians of both parties can shove billions of dollars into, making contractors wealthy and their own jobs secure. A Monday morning Reuters news story confirms that the National Security Administration shares unknown quantities of its vacuum cleaner surveillance of every American's electronics communications and whereabouts with the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, which duly passes it on to thousands of state and local police agencies in every jurisdiction. Just as the power-mad generals at NSA pretend that everything they do is perfectly legal, DEA spokespeople also assure us that no laws are broken, even though their own manuals counsel local police to lie about their sources of information and instruct them where possible to foggy up so-called reconstructive investigations to yield material usable in court and free from annoying exculpatory evidence. The information pipeline between the NSA, the DEA, your local police departments, and assorted private contractors is not overseen, not even by legislators sworn by secrecy or by clandestine courts. All oversight is in the hands of the Drug Enforcement Administration, a federal agency created for the express purpose of publicizing, politicizing, and prosecuting the failed 40 years war on drugs. Given this complete lack of oversight, can we even begin to take seriously their declarations about the limits of the information they pass on and the uses it's put to? If the Bush-Cheney gang were still in the White House, the assurances of NSA generals and DEA cops, along with purported inquiries into the legality of these processes by a Department of Justice which recently pronounced that being profiled at a White House Terror Tuesday meeting was all the due process required before summary execution by drone, these assurances would be met with a relentless storm of disbelief and ridicule. But in the upside-down universe of liberals in this, the age of Obama, violations of due process, mass incarceration, vacuum cleaner surveillance of the digital lives and correspondence of all Americans, and passing the results of this unconstitutional surveillance on to local police are beneath the notice of black and white Democrats, unworthy of comment even by black leaders who claim to oppose mass incarceration. It may have taken the Bush-Cheney gang to initiate the so-called war on terror, but only Barack Obama, only a black Democrat in the White House could make it okay in the eyes of black and white liberals to bring that war home in the form of border walls, universal surveillance, and the sharing of that surveillance data with local cops and contractors who conceal its origin at the same time they claim that everything they do is legal. And nobody even laughs.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.